Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
In the new book, Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East, David Rode, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, answers the questions that now confuse many Americans. Can the U.S. really walk away from the Middle East? Is the Arab Spring a cause for celebration or alarm? What happened in Benghazi? What is happening in Syria? What is the truth about drones? This book distills 11 years of expert reporting for the New York Times, Reuters, and The Atlantic to issue a call for a new, more pragmatic, and less military-oriented approach to a rapidly changing Middle East. It is a great pleasure to welcome David Rode to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
Give us a sense of, when you look at the Middle East, of what it takes to reimagine it and the American influence in a new Middle East.
I completely understand sort of the United States' fatigue with the region, and I frankly, you know, it would be great if we could just sort of walk away from it. The problem is that the oil there, even as the U.S., I think, you know, will become more energy independent with the new drilling that's emerged, the world economy is going to depend on oil from the Middle East. China gets, you know, 70-80% of its oil from the Middle East. So does Europe. And we do live in a kind of globalized economy, and we've seen that if there's a slowdown in Europe, it impacts the U.S. economy. So we've sort of somehow, you know, as you said, try to get a more pragmatic, less effective, and less military approach. One basic number, and I'll stop here. So in Iraq and Afghanistan, since 2001, we spent roughly $1.2 trillion. And in my reporting, I found that 95% of that money went to the military effort. And I think that there's a cheaper way, you know, if we focus on kind of economics and job creation, there's a cheaper way to create stability that's not so reliant on our military.
You just returned from a trip with Secretary of State Kerry. You continue to cover this beat. Do you have any inkling that there is a reimagining of our influence?
I think we need to reimagine our influence for a changed Middle East. I do think, and I would ask one thing, in terms of the Arab Spring, clearly things have changed, and there's people on the streets, and it started out as this sort of hopeful thing where young people were searching, you know, for democracy. I think many people still want that in the region. I would just suggest to people that what's going on isn't just chaos. There's actually a very sort of pivotal struggle going on across the Middle East between conservative Muslims, some of whom are, you know, radicalized and armed, and sort of more kind of liberal Muslims who, you know, are not, you know, who want, what they described to me was that they're very proud to be Muslims, but they also want to be modern at the same time. And they sort of don't want to be dictated to by, you know, armed American soldiers, and they also don't want to be, you know, dictated to by jihadists who want to live in the 12th century. And I'm sort of talking about countries like Turkey, which now has a faster-growing economy than Europe. Indonesia is outside of the Middle East, but it's the largest Muslim country in the world. Their economy is booming. The largest private airline in Indonesia just placed an order in March to buy $22 billion in Boeing aircraft. So there's more, you know, going on in the region than the chaos. And then when you see these sort of, you know, battles in the streets of Egypt, it's a very practical, logical struggle for power between the Muslim Brotherhood, which is more conservative, and kind of more secular Egyptians.
I'm curious, when you look at and you write about this in the book about the situation that obviously we've learned a little bit more about over the last few days and weeks, and that is what happened in Benghazi when four American diplomats were killed in Libya. When you look at a situation like that is so tainted with politics, of how you extract from that the real lesson that we need to extract from that?
I know more. I mean, I would want to break it into two separate things. There's the situation before the attack and the lack of resources the State Department had there, and I'll talk about that a bit more, and then the response afterwards, and that's what's, it's all become very politicized. I don't know as much about the response afterwards in Washington, but what I will definitely say, and I think this is very accurate and fair, is that, you know, over the years, you know, we've increased the size of the military, and there's been much smaller amounts of funding going to the State Department, and they were asked to do, you know, expand and mount a lot of efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. So in terms of securing its people, the State Department became dependent on private contractors. The most famous or infamous one was Blackwater in Iraq. You know, they were, you know, fairly or unfairly, the they were known, and it was widely reported that they would shoot civilians. So when Gaddafi falls, the new Libyan government, one of the first things they do is they ban the State Department or any foreign government from using foreign contractors to protect diplomatic facilities. And the State Department was so short on capacity, there's an office there called the Office of Diplomatic Security, that they literally didn't have enough people to send to Benghazi to create a stronger compound, to potentially move them to a safer compound, to just guard it. They were literally sending one, two, or three Americans on 4 to 6 week rotations. These were staff members of this Office of Diplomatic Security to guard Benghazi. Once they didn't have the ability to use contractors, there wasn't enough sort of institutional capacity to do that. And you know, that's part of what led to the tragedy there. You know, what happened afterwards, the response of the administration, you know, all these questions about the talking points, you know, I know less about that. But I do think, and this is a theme of the book, that we have to be in these regions. A lot of diplomats, you know, feel terrible about Chris Stevens' death, but they say diplomats have to take risks, that thousands of American soldiers have died, many more thousands have lost their limbs, and you're going to lose diplomats now and then. And you kind of let the jihadists win when they attack, you know, an outpost, kill these four Americans. You let them win if embassies become fortresses, and, you know, we can't, you know, risk the life of a single diplomat. It's sad and unfortunate, but it's going to happen. But we need to kind of be out there working with other people in the society. And the last thing on Benghazi, it didn't get as much attention in the news, but thousands of Libyans took to the streets and protested the killing of Chris Stevens. He was very popular. The U.S. was very popular for helping topple Gaddafi, and there's always this question about, are there moderates? And there really were moderates. They attacked the base of this Islamist group that carried out the killings. Many Libyans were really ashamed of it. It's a mess in that country, but there is another side to Libya.
The book is very much a call for change and highlighting this country's unsuccessful civilian efforts in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. So in a nutshell, what do we do to reverse that and ultimately to strengthen our own civilian institutions?
Thanks for asking, because the whole idea of this book came about when I was covering Afghanistan and Pakistan a little bit in Iraq. In that, in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, I remember cities falling in northern Iraq, and I was there. And, you know, it's sort of chaos. And literally you had these, you know, American, you know, majors or colonels sort of turning to their soldiers and saying, okay, you know, Sergeant Jones, you go start up the schools. Okay, you know, Sergeant Johnson, you go fix the electricity. Okay, Sergeant Smith, you start garbage collection. And all the members of the military were like, where are the civilians? You know, we don't know how to do this stuff. We don't know how to run an interim government, and there was a sense of this kind of lopsided approach. Post Benghazi, there's a real fear of taking risk in the State Department. There's a sense that they're underfunded and overstretched, and if you know, you feel that if you make one mistake, you're going to be pounced on by the press, by reporters like me, you know, or pounced on by, you know, opposition members of Congress. And I think this would be true, you know, if Mitt Romney were president today. I think we have such a kind of trench warfare political culture in Washington now that it's just attack, attack, attack. And I, you know, it's sort of idealistic to, you know, to say that it should change, but it really is limiting our ability to kind of use economic tools to, you know, work with these moderate groups, the ones that were protesting Stephen's death. You know, and I feel like we're almost paralyzed because our institutions are so weak. You know, it's not popular to fund the State Department. It's popular to fund the Pentagon, but we need a sort of more well-rounded approach. And on economics, I was in Tunisia last year. You know, young people there want to work for Google. They want to be part of the world economy. They really admire American technology. There was a delegation. This was a great, you know, program that started up in the post-Arab Spring to Tunisia. It sent American high-tech executives, some people from eBay, some angel investors, to the region. They had a competition where young Tunisians would pitch their ideas for starting a high-tech startup companies in Tunisia. Great idea, you know, creates jobs, everything else. But the program was so poorly funded that the members of the delegation, as they were judging this competition, they learned that the State Department had not, there was no prize for the winning young Tunisian entrepreneur. It was a young woman who wanted to start a biotech startup in Tunisia. So the members of the delegation, you know, cobbled together a prize themselves, and this young woman got a three-month internship in a, it's called the Tech Town High-Tech Incubator in Detroit, Michigan. And frankly, we've got to do better than that. We've got to use, we are the best in the world at high-tech, the best in the world at venture capital. You know, we're great at infrastructure and great now in energy. And we've got to kind of use those economic assets to promote, you know, jobs where it makes sense in this part of the world.
And the point you make in the book is that it's not too late.
No, I don't think so. And this is back to these young peoples and this idea of the moderates that are out there. I think that, you know, globalization is happening. It's real. I was a little bit off. I was in Moscow this week with Secretary Kerry. There's this young kind of professional middle class emerging in Moscow, and they're emerging also in Istanbul and Turkey and in Tunis and Tunisia. I interviewed recently when President Obama was in Israel. He talked about 100 new high-tech startups that exist in on the West Bank. They're Palestinian runs. I talked to one 45-year-old Palestinian that, you know, is doing kind of back office work. It's just like the work that is done in India, but they're doing back-office work for the Arab, you know, sort of market for Cisco and Hewlett-Packard and Alcatel-Lucent. And, you know, there are radicals and very dangerous elements there. I'm not, you know, that's an issue completely. But there is this desire to be part of the world, to be sort of proud of their cultures and to you know, be accepted in it. So I really think that if we kind of, first of all, scale back our ambitions, you know, in terms of we're going to turn everything into a democracy, focus on economics, you know, when private investment makes sense, there could be loan guarantees for American companies in these countries and have these kind of delegations, you know, think of creative ways. There's been big advances in health changes in Africa that have improved poverty reduction, microfinance, use of mobile phone technology, and we should kind of try to use some of those same new innovations in these regions and work through local people, create businessmen, train security forces. It's always better, you know, when we're doing it through or with local allies, you know, versus, you know, carrying out these costly invasions.
The book is powerful and so important, and it is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. David Rode, I thank you so much for spending time with us, and I wish all the luck in the world in the future you're reporting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. David Rode is a columnist for Reuters and The Atlantic, a former reporter for The New York Times, and a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.